When you buy Kroger brand products, you feel like you're winning. That's because they offer proven quality at lower than low prices. In fact, we guarantee that you and your family will love how Kroger brand products taste, or you get your money back. So next time you're shopping for the family, look for delicious Kroger brand products, because they'll make you all feel like you're winning. Shop now, in-store, or online. Kroger, fresh for everyone.
If a new house is on your wish list in the next 5 years, grow your savings faster and experience your dreams with an Ohio Homebuyer Plus account from Kemba Financial Credit Union. A savings account specifically designed to save for a new home where you can earn 7% APY, a $500 matching bonus, and a $1,500 mortgage closing cost credit. Learn more at Kemba.org. Offer expires March 31st, 2025. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. NMLS 292230. Equal housing lender. Federally insured by NCUA.
What's up, this your boy Lil Duval, and check out my podcast, Conversations with Unc, on the Black Effect Podcast Network. Each and every Tuesday, Conversations with Unc podcast feature casual and in-depth talk about ebbs and flows of life and the pursuit of happiness. Unlike my work on stage, I tap into a more serious and sensitive side to give life advice and simply offer words of encouragement, yet remind folks to never forget to laugh. Every Tuesday, listen to Conversations with Unc, hosted by Lil Duval on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Presented by AT&T. Connecting changes everything.
Are you still searching for your perfect place to call home? Well, now is the time to buy at Fisher Homes. If you're looking to move in before the end of 2024, May could be your last opportunity to start building your dream home and close before the year's end. If you're hoping to move in even sooner, Fisher Homes also has homes that are move-in ready and waiting for you, where you can start enjoying the benefits of homeownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with a new home advisor today at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home.
This episode is brought to you by Navy Federal Credit Union. At Navy Federal, it's been the mission to help the military community for over 90 years. And not just help them, but do everything to make sure they not only grow, but flourish. That's why Navy Federal Credit Union has all kinds of great savings and investment options, like share certificates with sky-high rates. So don't hesitate. Start growing your finances today with a variety of savings and investment options. Navy Federal Credit Union. Our members are the mission. Savings products insured by NCUA. Investment products are not insured, not obligations of Navy Federal and may lose value.
Brought to you by Toyota. Let's go places. Welcome to Forward Thinking.
Hey there, and welcome to Forward Thinking, the podcast that looks at the future and says, here I am, rock you like a hurricane. I'm Jonathan Strickland.
I'm Lauren Vogelbaum.
And Joe, you will do Joe as the scorpions did before you.
Yeah.
Joe is shaking his head.
I am Joe McCormick. Today we are going to be talking about storms. Storms? Is that the topic?
Yes. Well, specifically
what's
hurricanes.
What's it called when there's wind and water comes down from the sky?
that's a storm.
The apocalypse?
Okay. Yeah. Well, we're going to specifically talk about hurricanes today.
Yes.
The future of hurricanes, because you may have heard various climate change scientists, climatologists, and various computer scientists talking about models that are trying to predict what the world will be like in the future due to climate change. One of the things that always pops up is the discussion of hurricanes. So we wanted to kind of take that topic and explore what we know and what we don't know. Talk about, like, what are we fairly certain about? What sort of elements are really kind of just a best guess scenario?
Yeah, I think it's worth pointing out as a disclaimer at the beginning of this episode that there seems to be a little bit less agreement here than on climate change generally.
Sure.
People sometimes seem to confuse these two points. But just to reiterate something we've said on the show before, that the planet is warming, there's really no disputing. But exactly what the effects are going to be, or at least what some of the effects are going to be, is still being debated.
Oh, absolutely. Because tracking trends is a pretty easy data collection. But and by pretty easy, I mean ridiculously difficult in a global effort in this
right.
particular case. Mm-hmm. But yeah, trying to figure out what that's going to do to global weather systems or very specific weather systems is whole. That's a whole other separate
yeah.
issue.
Yeah, and we've talked
not to say that we can't say anything interesting about it.
Sure.
And that scientists can't create accurate models. I think that we very likely can. But just to establish at the beginning, this is not as settled as climate change science in the general sense.
Yeah. And it's something that you'll, if you read into it, it's something that the climatologists themselves will say up front, usually.
Yeah,
like,
they talk about which model they're using.
Right.
Right. Because the models are doing their best to take as many factors into account to simulate what would actually happen in the real world as possible. But we've talked about it before, how weather systems are notoriously complex and intricate. And we don't have a full understanding of how weather systems work on a part where we can actually definitively say, here's what is going to happen.
Right.
Here is when it will happen.
Yeah. But with all those qualifications in mind, I think it would be really interesting to talk about what scientists are saying about what the storms of the future are going to look like.
Yeah. So going with hurricanes, let's talk about, you know, laying down the groundwork so we understand what we're saying when we actually use the word hurricane. I think most of us have an idea of what that is, especially those of us who live along the east coast of the United States. But
yep,
the word cyclone is also often used.
Sure. Previous Florida resident, yes.
Someone who, I've certainly seen my share of weather effects that came to us courtesy of a hurricane. Of course, Atlanta is so far inland that we don't get the brunt of any sort of hurricane hitting landfall, but we definitely get the storms that are a result of that.
Oh, yeah. It's interesting. If you've never lived in a part of the world that gets tropical cyclones, hurricanes, whatever, coming in, it's interesting to see the dregs of a hurricane. They come through here all the time.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Somebody else south of us got hit really hard, and we just get a bad rainstorm, pretty much.
And, of course, recently we've seen hurricanes, like recently as in the last 5 years, we've seen hurricanes hit some places that normally don't see much hurricane activity at all, like New York City.
Yeah,
sure, because the storm generally will disperse before it ever gets there.
Yeah. So let's talk about what is going on with hurricane formation and why they disperse when they get to certain areas. First, we have to talk about atmospheric pressure.
Right. So when the atmospheric pressure reaches a certain level, the goddess of the equatorial ocean becomes very angry.
You know, I was hoping that by forbidding the mystical acts from the studio, we would avoid such things. But apparently there's just no stopping you, Joe.
Wait, are you saying that weather is caused by physical forces?
It is, in fact, caused by physical forces
and not
those that emanate from some soggy tart at the bottom of the ocean.
I've been misinformed. Well, please enlighten me, Jonathan.
So atmosphere has weight. Right. It's
as we say, I feel like about once a week on this show, like the air is not thin. It is soup.
Yes, it is soup. And that means that the soup toward the bottom is being squished by all the soup at the top.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So the air toward the bottom of toward the surface, near the surface of the earth, whether it's land or ocean, is being compressed by the air molecules that are higher up. And the air closer to the surface is being warmed not directly by the sun, but rather through the heat that is emanating from the warmed landmass and ocean water.
So the sun warms the water and the land, and then it radiates the heat back up into the air.
Right. Mm-hmm. So then as air heats up, the molecules that make up the air start to move apart from one another. They start getting active, right? The molecular activity increases. That is what heat is ultimately. And so the density of the air decreases as a result. The molecules are moving apart. Now, this creates the movement of the less dense air rising up while denser air, cooler air, sinks down to take its place. Nature abhors a vacuum. So it's not like the warm air can just rise up and nothing else happens, which is good because otherwise we would not be here. But this movement is called the pressure gradient force. Now, over the oceans, warm air also happens to have a lot of water vapor in it. Who'da thunk?
Weird.
Yeah. So water's evaporating. It becomes part of the air here. And as warm air and water vapor together rise up, the vapor begins to condense once it hits a certain temperature. And then you get storm clouds forming and eventually rain. Condensation, by the way, releases heat as a byproduct. This is not a big surprise. To form water vapor, we add heat to water. When water vapor becomes water, it releases heat. That energy has to go somewhere. We cannot obviously create or destroy energy. Now, that's called the latent heat of condensation, and that heat warms the cool air that's up at the top and causes that to rise, and that starts to create a vacuum effect that pulls even more warm air from the surface up through this channel, right? Now, as this continues, more heat and water gets moved through the atmosphere, and this movement begins to create a circular pattern of motion. So this is kind of like what you see when you open up a drain and you watch the water, you know, circle down the drain, similar to that. But this one is actually determined by the Coriolis effect, whereas the drain water is not.
Oh, well, yeah. I mean, it.
The Simpsons was wrong.
Yes. Yeah. There's a tendency, but it's a, but a drain is too small of a water system to be affected by.
Exactly. The Coriolis effect is real, and it is because of the rotation of the Earth, but it generally only affects large systems, not your toilet or the sink. Now, in the northern hemisphere, storms rotate counterclockwise. In the southern hemisphere, they rotate clockwise. Or, as I once saw in a set of instructions to build a fan, and I am not making this up, anti-counterclockwise, which seems a little
well, that's
wordy.
Very precise.
Yes, like, turn this anti-counterclockwise. Really? Not just clockwise?
Not just clockwise? No.
So then also, especially near the equatorial regions of the Earth, you have converging winds near the surface of the water. These are colliding with one another and pushing even more warm air upward. This increases the rotational speed of the storm, and strong winds at high altitudes move the warm air out from the center, and that's what becomes the eye of the storm. So you've got this relatively calm area in the very center, and then this sort of tumultuous area, especially the area right around the center, that the wind speeds there are at their highest, mm-hmm. but it then radiates outward. Now, if you have different speeds of wind along these various elevations of the storm system, that's what's called wind shear. When you have wind shear, it actually inhibits the growth of a storm. So if you've got, you know, winds from the east and north hitting at one point at one speed, and they're hitting at a totally different speed at a different elevation along that storm system, it takes more energy for the storm system to grow, and it's less likely to become a hurricane. If all that air is – all that wind is blowing at the same speed, then it's more likely to turn into a hurricane and get stronger. Now, as that warm air is moved from the center, cool air rushes down to replace it. High-pressure air is pulled into a low-pressure center that increases the wind speed even more, and that's when you start actually getting into the realm of a hurricane. Now, only a few storms out in the ocean ever reach hurricane status, like out of all of them, if you, mm-hmm. from a percentage basis.
Sure.
It may be that you might have a hurricane season where you have an abnormally large number of hurricanes. But if you look at the overall number of storms, they'll still be relatively small percentage. Most storms tend to die out before they reach that level. So here's the general categorization. First, you've got the tropical depressions. This does not mean that people in that area are starting to feel kind of gloomy.
Well, it's cloudy out, I suppose.
Yeah, it could be like, man, I booked our vacation and it's just raining. No, tropical depression are marked with wind speeds that are less than 38 miles per hour or around 61 kilometers an hour. Then tropical depressions can grow into tropical storms. Those have wind speeds that range between 39 and 73 miles per hour or 63 to 117 kilometers per hour. Tropical storms then can grow into hurricanes. Now, your basic hurricane, like your Category 1 hurricane, has wind speeds greater than 74 miles per hour or 119 kilometers per hour. But we do classify hurricanes here in the United States in five categories. Australia is a little different, but U.S., it's five categories. It's also a five-category system in Australia, but they use different criteria. So Category 1 hurricane here in the U.S. is the weakest. They have wind speeds between 74 and 95 miles per hour, or 119 to 154 kilometers an hour. Meanwhile, if you go to the other side of the scale, a Category 5 storm, which is one you do not want to be in, it is with wind speeds greater than 155 miles per hour or 250 kilometers an hour. So the winds are bad, right? The winds are incredibly damaging, but that's not necessarily the most damaging part of a hurricane. In fact, now they are responsible for what could be the most damaging part of a hurricane, but it's not a direct relationship. We're talking about storm surge.
Right.
So storm surge is where you get a...
Who's knocking on the door? It's water.
Yeah, it's just like a wall of water. Storm surge is created because the winds of the hurricane are pushing water outward from the center. And that's where you get like an enormous mass of water just coming in, much higher than the normal sea level, much higher than the normal high tide line. So with this, you could say the more powerful hurricanes create larger storm surges. Not a big surprise. More wind pushes more water. So a Category 1 storm tends to cause about a 4 to 5 foot rise in the sea level from the storm surge, which is significant depending mm-hmm. upon if you live in a coastal city. That could be incredibly significant. Category 5 has a storm surge of greater than 18 feet cool. or 5.5 meters. That's a huge amount of water. And that's where you're getting into some really deadly territory.
Yeah, and of course, one of the things to remember is that the negative impact of a storm, like a hurricane, might not always necessarily be just directly related to how powerful it is, like how fast the winds are or how high the storm surge is. It can also be related to where it hits
yeah.
and how well prepared the places it hits are.
Absolutely.
Because like one place might get a tougher hurricane, but it just might be better defended against hurricanes.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Higher seawalls or better construction material or...
Or even yeah. things that are off the coast, like things like an oyster bed can help slow down wave formation.
Sure.
In fact, New York City used to have very healthy oyster beds outside of it. Used to being the operative term.
Have we eaten too many oysters?
There's a walrus and a carpenter that came through and things just got ugly.
Wait a second. Do people eat New York City oysters?
It was more that things got destroyed.
Too polluted.
Destroyed in okay. construction trawling yeah. stuff out and things like mm. that. But
the oyster menu. Ooh, New York City's finest oysters.
You can really taste the Brooklyn in this one.
I like New York City oysters before they were cool. The conditions for hurricane formation are not everywhere. That's why you don't see hurricanes all over the earth. We talked about how in the equatorial region you have these converging winds. That's one of the necessary features in order to have hurricane formation. Another is that the water needs to be warm. This warm air and water vapor are key elements. They are what feed into a hurricane's power. And so you need water that's at least 27 degrees Celsius or about 80 degrees Fahrenheit in order for hurricanes to actually form in the first place. This is why we don't see hurricanes forming in like the northern Atlantic.
This is why they happen around the equator.
Yeah. And as they move around, as they start to encounter colder water or they hit land, then you start to cut off the process that feeds these hurricanes. That warm water vapor is no longer present, so the hurricane begins to dissipate. Its energy starts to it's not being constantly refed.
Fed.
Yeah, so
right.
it just dies. So the Hurricane Sandy that hit New York, one of the reasons why it was able to be such a powerful storm in the first place was that the water temperatures around that time were abnormally high. High enough so that the storm had not lost a significant amount of power before it made landfall. It also was what they called a hybrid storm, but that goes into far more complex detail than I am prepared to talk about on this podcast. At any rate, that's the basic rules of how a hurricane behaves, and that's like right now. So now we have to transition into talking about what about projecting forward, as we know that climate change is a thing. We know that it is happening and will continue to happen, particularly.
And at this point, we can't really stop it.
We can't stop it. What we can do is mitigate how bad it will be,
uh-huh.
right? We can do that by limiting greenhouse gas emissions, for example, and other means.
Mm-hmm. And we can try to mitigate the potential effects of climate change.
Exactly, by making preparations in the places where it's most likely to have the greatest
impact.
Yeah. Yeah. Because, I mean, there's certain things of climate change that are going to be a real issue for lots of different people. In dry areas, it's likely to get more dry. In areas that are of a tropical or subtropical region, they might get much more rain than they usually do. These are just general trends that we may see. But what about hurricanes? Well, this is, like Joe says, really complicated.
Right. So pretty much everybody agrees that climate change is going to do something to hurricanes. So they agree that it will change the conditions that create hurricanes. But what's not exactly agreed upon is exactly how they will change them.
Now, most of the models that I have looked at have said that the changes are going to include more intense hurricanes.
Yeah.
Hurricanes with stronger winds, greater sea surge, larger. They'll be affecting larger areas. And if we see a rise in ocean temperature, we're likely also to see a greater ranging of hurricanes because the conditions will be more appropriate for a hurricane to feed itself in a broader area than it used to be.
Yeah, it'll suddenly be balmy enough in, say, Scotland to make it happen.
Right.
Yeah. Or not suddenly, but
no. But Nessie might find herself having a bit of a rough day. A bit of a rough day. Yeah.
I know I've read differing opinions about whether the frequency of hurricanes is going to go up or down.
Yeah, this is one of those things. Generally speaking, most models, not all, but most models suggest that we are going to see fewer hurricanes form, but the ones that form will be worse, like they'll be stronger.
Mm-hmm.
Most models do, not all of them. So we know that the temperature is going to affect hurricanes. We know this change in sea level is really going to affect hurricanes too, in the sense that it'll affect how they impact us. If sea levels continue to rise, which we expect they will, then coastal cities that are already maybe just a few feet above sea level are going to be more prone to damage in the case of any kind of storm, not just a hurricane, but any sort of tropical depression or tropical storm can create enough of a sea surge to cause massive flooding in those areas.
Right. So if your city is, 10 feet above sea level and sea levels rise 5 feet, that could still hurt you.
Yes.
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
And also you're going to start eroding those low coastal areas that help slow down hurricanes in many places before they hit land.
And even if you've built barriers, if the sea level rises, the sea level may rise above the barrier you built, in which case there's not much of a help there. So getting back to frequency, like what Joe was saying, we do have these differing opinions, these differing models. I guess I should say models, not opinions, because it's what the computers are projecting.
Mm-hmm.
One expert in hurricanes
is, it's real bad science to just have opinions about stuff.
I don't like hurricanes, so I just don't think they're going to happen anymore. it's not going to really help. Dr. Kerry Emanuel from MIT created a model that suggested climate change would create more weak storms around the Category 1 to 2 area and increase the intensity of stronger storms. So in other words, his model,
it's a 1-2 punch.
Yeah, it's a double whammy. It's both, we get more storms and more of them will be stronger. That is not great news. Now, granted, that's the one that's sort of, it's almost of a dissenting opinion than the other models, right? The other models do suggest that we're going to probably see fewer hurricanes. One of the reasons is they predict more wind shear. And as I said earlier, more wind shear would inhibit the formation of storms. So the ones that do form could be incredibly intense, but there would be fewer in number. So that's one of the reasons. Another is that the differences in temperature between the polar regions and the equatorial regions help fuel some of the storms that then grow into hurricanes. And if that difference is decreased because the polar regions are heating up, and we would expect the polar regions to heat up more dramatically than equatorial, we would think the equatorial region would remain more or less the same temperature. It might increase a little bit, but not at the level. The colder regions are the ones that are going to increase the most, like the most dramatic change in the short term. Short term being like a century. It's a relative term.
Mm-hmm.
But that, if we see that difference decrease, that might mean that we see fewer storms forming initially. So those are the ways that the two models, and there are more than two, but those are the ways different models disagree on what can happen. But both appear to support the idea that the storms we get are going to be doozies. They're going to be pretty powerful. And we've been able to do some preliminary measurements, but nothing that is conclusive yet. So, for instance, we know that ocean temperatures have increased slightly since 1980 by like 0.3 degrees Celsius. So the temperature has gone up. Now, that predicts that hurricane wind strength should rise on average about a knot more in strength and speed, really. So one knot faster than what they had been previous in the 1980 numbers on average.
But how do you measure how fast a hurricane wind is moving?
Well, you can do it through lots of things like satellite imagery. You can do it through – you can actually send measurement tools into a hurricane if you wanted to.
Can you do it with precision down to one knot?
No, you cannot. The margin of error is plus or minus 5 knots. So the measurement here would be within the range of error. Hmm. So we cannot determine with any accuracy whether or not the prediction has come true because it hasn't been – drastic enough for us to be able to definitively say, all right, this is outside the margin of error. We are sure that this is happening. So that means it's a little too early for us to say through direct observation. But that being said, the information we do have shows that hurricanes appear to be strengthening faster than they have in the past. So maybe even if they're not stronger than they were, they're getting stronger faster.
You mean from the time of formation
to the time they hit like category 3 or category 4. It's taking less time for them to grow to those levels than it used to. So essentially the hurricanes today are eating their Wheaties is what we're getting at. It was found, according to NASA, that that some researchers discovered that storms were attaining category 3 wind speeds nearly 9 hours faster than they did back in 1980. Which is significant.
Yeah. That's every hour counts, especially when you're trying to prepare a population for that kind of incoming storm.
Right. And keep in mind also that we only are able to predict potential pathways the storm will follow. We know the general direction that they'll follow. But that means if you've ever lived in a coastal area and you've seen those projection paths, you see it's like a triangle that starts from the storm and then broadens out.
Yeah, it's a cone of anxiety, really. It's just horrifying, like lying vaguely within that cone,
right,
and going like, well, anything could happen, really.
Yeah. Now, if your city is dead center in the middle of that cone, you've got a real good chance of being hit by that hurricane, whether it's head on or by the edge or whatever. Now, we've also seen that global wind speeds have increased over the last 20 years by 5%. So that also suggests that hurricanes may be getting stronger faster because wind plays such a big part in hurricanes. But without the direct observation to back up that data or that prediction, we can't say for sure. And as good science dictates, you want to measure, you want to be able to replicate, you want to make sure that your observations in fact represent as close to reality as we can possibly get. So it would be irresponsible for us to say, yes, hurricanes have definitely gotten stronger over the last 25 years. It just the data seems to be pointing us in that direction, but we don't have the definitive answer yet. Now, we may also see stuff like the jet streams actually being affected. So in other words, the massive currents, essentially, this pathway that tends to dictate which way hurricanes go, that could change. It could slow down, which would mean the hurricane would spend longer out in the warm areas of the ocean, building up stronger and stronger before continuing in to hit, you know, landmass or colder water, which means they could have a even more energy than we've ever calculated before as a result. So that's a possibility. So this all sounds kind of scary. It gets scarier once you start to look at who's at risk. Obviously, if you live in Nebraska, you're probably not too worried about hurricanes.
Well, you might be worried about some other effects of climate change, such as maybe drought or something like
right.
that.
Right. We don't know how climate change might affect things like tornadoes, for example. It may or may not. We don't know.
I think I was reading earlier today that there's no evidence so far that climate change has an effect on tornadoes, but that was just one thing I read.
Yeah.
Could be disputed by others.
Right. It's one of those things. Well, for one thing, we we don't know what we don't know. And it may very well be that climate change has no meaningful impact on the number or intensity of tornadoes that we'll see. It's quite possible. But we have seen some studies about who would most likely be affected by hurricanes in a negative way. Not just most likely to be hit by a hurricane, but if a hurricane did hit, which cities would suffer the most damage in a monetary sense. So the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, or OECD, crunched some numbers back in 2013 to figure out which coastal cities are most at risk due to rising sea levels and intense storms. Guangzhou, which is a port city northwest of Hong Kong, topped the list. But there were other cities that were on it, like Miami, New York City, New Orleans, Mumbai, Nagoya, Tampa, Boston, Shenzhen, and Osaka were all on that list. And this is essentially saying these are the cities that, if they were hit by a hurricane, would suffer the most damages monetarily, like billions of dollars.
Yeah, it's not measuring the strength of hurricanes that could potentially hit there,
right.
Just the fact that if they do get hit,
yeah,
kind of at all.
Yeah, exactly. It's,
they could have the most to lose.
It's like saying, you know, if this city were hit by an earthquake, this is how much – and it was an earthquake of a significant strength.
Yeah.
This is how much damage would happen because they don't prepare for earthquakes.
Structurally prepared, right, exactly.
Right, exactly, yeah. So they also looked at comparing the expense of damages to the GDP of these various cities, the gross domestic product of these cities. Which, by the way, if you want to learn more about GDP, How Stuff Works has a video about it.
Yeah, you can go to brainstuffshow.com and find an excellent video that Jonathan hosted.
Yeah.
And did you write that one, Joe?
I did.
Joe,
yeah.
Well, there you go. Yeah.
Yeah, so two out of
team
the,
effort.
Yeah, we and Lauren was there. So
probably I'm always watching.
Yeah. She is. She makes sure that I say the words that Joe wrote, because otherwise I go off script and terrible things happen. So when we look at the comparison of damages to GDP, the list changes up a little bit. Guangzhou is still top of the list, but New Orleans is on there as well. But there's also Guayaquil from Ecuador. I apologize, by the way, for mangling the pronunciation of these cities. Ho Chi Minh City, Abidjan, Zhangjiang, Mumbai, Khulna, which is in Bangladesh, Palembang, which is in Indonesia, and Shenzhen were all at the top of that list. So essentially these are the cities that could least afford this sort of disaster. And, you know, Guangzhou was on both lists, so
yeah.
that's rough.
Yeah.
Now, the cities that are predicted to have the greatest increase of risk of flooding are those that currently have a low risk of flooding. And the reason for that is these are cities that have not invested in infrastructure that would be protective against flooding from sea surge, because traditionally they haven't been in the pathway of hurricanes. But as we've said, one of the consequences of this climate change is that we're going to see more cities that traditionally would not really be in the path of a hurricane potentially find themselves smack dab in the middle of one. So those cities included Alexandria in Egypt, Barranquilla in Colombia, Naples in Italy, and Sapporo in Japan, and Santo Domingo in the Dominican Republic. So those are all cities that could potentially suffer severe flooding, largely because they are unprepared for it. And, you know, again, if you live in a place where a natural disaster rarely, if ever, occurs, it doesn't seem to make any sense to prepare for it, right?
Sure.
Like here in Atlanta, we do live not that far from a fault line, but we rarely get an earthquake that's even strong enough for us to feel.
Mm-hmm.
Like earthquakes do happen, but we almost never feel them. I think there have been two that were, you know, of a great enough magnitude to notice since I've lived in Atlanta, and that's been like 20 years.
Yeah.
So it wouldn't make sense for us to build everything in Atlanta to withstand massive earthquakes. It just doesn't happen. Same sort of thing for cities that traditionally have not been in the path of hurricanes. I've also looked at some other lists. AccuWeather actually looked at they looked at it a different way. They looked at the cities that are most likely to be affected by a hurricane in any given hurricane season. They actually had it by a percentage of how likely within a hurricane season any of these individual cities would be hit.
Mm-hmm. And looking just here in the U.S.,
yeah,
right?
Just here in the U.S., actually just here on the U.S. and on the East Coast. So The top five were Miami and Key West, both in Florida, Cape Hatteras, which is in North Carolina, Tampa, back in Florida, and New Orleans. So these would be the places that statistically are most likely to be hit by hurricanes simply because of the path that hurricanes currently take.
Sure.
So if you look at those two lists, with Miami being at risk, it's been identified as being at risk for lots and lots of damage. Like they've not been hit by a massive hurricane in a while, but that's a warning sign because they're also one of the more likely cities to be hit. So those two in combination, plus rising sea levels and increased hurricane intensity, tell you that the people of Miami have some big concerns about this.
So obviously it's time to start thinking about ways to prepare and solutions.
Yeah, and sadly, there are no easy answers.
Well, I've got one I think is pretty good, okay?
Yeah.
I think we're as a country pretty good at claiming we're going to build a wall. So I think we should build a wall along the southern and eastern coast of the United States that stretches up to the top of the atmosphere.
Right.
And then that would just block
the top of the atmosphere.
Yeah, right. And that would just block any incoming storm.
The shade from that would be phenomenal. Yeah, that's not likely to happen because I can't imagine it being physically possible for us to build a structure of such height.
Where's your can-do attitude, Jonathan?
It's a can-don't for that one. Obviously, there'd be way too many problems with that, clearly. I mean, first of all, just redirecting all the flights. Look, if I'm going to go to Mexico, I don't want my flight to Atlanta to have to take me all the way through, like, Oregon so I can get around this wall. The seawalls are something that cities do build in order to protect against sea surge and things like that, massive waves. Sea barriers are a known solution to these problems, but they are temporary solutions, particularly in the era of sea levels on the rise.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So imagine you're in a coastal city.
Yeah.
And you're in one of these danger zones where the sea levels are expected to come up to where they might be sloshing in on your town.
Yeah.
And the local solution is, well, we're going to build some seawalls.
Yeah, that doesn't keep the water from sloshing up on your town, right?
Yeah, I mean, that's not very reassuring.
No, the seawalls are great for protecting against sea surges if the sea level itself is you know, not going to be on the rise.
Sounds like a temporary solution.
It is a temporary solution. It's one of the ones that New York City, when in the wake of Sandy, they were looking at ways to prepare in case this should ever happen again. And seawalls were one of the things they were talking about. But a lot of experts were saying, you know, guys, this is at best a temporary solution that will just stave off any massive disaster for the short term, but it's not a long-term fix. And if that means that we procrastinate, that we don't adopt tougher but more realistic solutions, then we're just inviting disaster further down the line.
Oh, well, so what's a realistic solution for something like this? I mean, none of us are Baba Yaga. We can't just like put chicken legs on our hut and raise it up in case of danger.
That's an excellent, I'm so glad you made that reference, Baba Yaga. Well, elevating buildings is one of the things that people have suggested. Now, granted, that does not work in a super dense urban environment like New York City, right? You can't expect to suddenly be able to raise everything up. Like, even if you were to say, all right, here's the deal. All of your front street entrances are now going to be a third floor basement.
Oof.
And we're going to move all the entrances up to – we're going to go up several floors. That's going to be your front door, and we're going to build up from there so that we have effectively grown higher than what the sea level is. That is maybe a solution for some communities, but not for a place like New York City where you've got millions and millions of people
who would be displaced by that kind of action.
But
yeah.
But it mostly refers to like making sure you have things like park space and other things that are right along the coastline as opposed to housing, because the coastline is obviously going to be the first place affected by sea surge. These are tough things where it requires massive redesign and relocation. Relocation is the other big possible solution. It's another tough one. The scientist I was reading referred to it as managed retreat.
Oof.
Yeah, to say like, well,
that is a wonderful wonderful euphemism.
Well, the point was, they said, like, this is not going to change. It's going to continue. It's going to get worse. And so
your beautiful beachfront property is not going to be a plus.
No, it's going to be beyond beach property at that point. It's going to be ocean property, not ocean front, but in the ocean. And so it's one of those deals where, you know, you have to really seriously look at the consequences and say, we are going at some point, we're going to have to move people out of here. We can't perpetually keep everyone here. It's just not possible. It's not a realism. We got to figure out another solution. So what we have to do now is think about what that solution is so that when it gets closer to the time when people have to move, they actually do have a place to move to. It doesn't do us any good to say, well, we'll figure that out when it comes, because then it'll just have another chaotic mess on our hands. So the suggestions I've seen have been, start putting into place a plan for managed retreat, perhaps even going so far as to create a system in which people who own a house will be guaranteed a location in this new place. Like, that is, they will still have a home, because the land that they owned will now be transferred to a different spot. Think about it. Millions of people. That is not an easy thing to manage.
Well,
oh, certainly.
Look at any population density map. Where are the most people gathered? They're along coastlines.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know, it's...
Well, it's where trade happens.
Yeah.
It's where gentler weather traditionally has happened. Oops.
Yeah. Well, and you know, there's just one of those things, like, that it's people are drawn to the ocean.
It's pretty.
It is pretty. I mean, I know that when I go on vacation to any ocean area, I want to have a house that has ocean views, right? I don't want to be one block back and I can hear it, but I can't see it.
Stuck facing the parking lot.
Yeah, I don't want that. So, I mean, I get it. And I happen to live in a city where I have the luxury of not having to worry about this as early as everyone else does. Mm-hmm. Not to say that Atlanta would be completely immune. I mean, we live on a Piedmont. We're not in the mountains yet. So, if the sea levels rose truly dramatically, it could get to the point where Atlanta would become a coastal city, and imagine that. But, yeah, that's another thing to worry about, that the solutions that you pick may not be long term. Even in that case, you would have to really look at the elevation of land and how far away from sea level is it, and you know, would it be affected by that same rise in sea level?
Yeah.
I think the solution is we just all move to the Himalayas.
Yeah,
it's called the water world contingency.
Got it. All right. Well,
yeah, yeah, and then on top of that, of course, you have to start thinking about the other infrastructure, not just the buildings, but the sewer systems, the electrical systems.
Yeah, we saw this in New York City as well. The massive problems they had with their power grid and the subway systems. That we have to make sure that that infrastructure can withstand something like a massive flooding. And you know, we probably talked about it more on Tech Stuff than here on Forward Thinking, but the power grid, particularly in the United States, is very much a patchwork sort of thing. And some of that patchwork dates back to the dawn of the electricity age. So, an upgrade is sorely needed. It's just one of those things that when you get it in place and it works, it's hard to justify the expense of changing it.
Oh, sure. Yeah. It's like, well, this is close enough for right now. So
yeah, it's meeting our needs. And yeah, stuff breaks, but we can fix it pretty fast. Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, we can fix it pretty fast under normal conditions, but not in the wake of a hurricane necessarily. So this has been, you know, really interesting to look into. It's one of those things that I still think we have the complete capability to make these decisions and make them in a way that has the least possible negative impact, but only if we start thinking about it earlier rather than later. The longer we hold off on coming up with viable solutions for people who live in these cities that are at risk, the harder it's going to be when that time comes, when we get to a point where we have to make the call of, all right, that's it, Miami, that's it for Miami. You know, we've got to move everybody from there. So
kind of the opposite of Miami 2025.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. It's, you know, it means that I gotta rethink where I'm retiring. So there's that. But anyway, this has been kind of a darker episode in many ways, but it's one that is necessary, I think. One of those where, you know, one, it's necessary for us to maintain optimism mm-hmm. and to apply that to solutions so that we can, you know, not denialism, not to say optimism right. to the point where we don't accept what's happening.
But before we can come up with solutions for this kind of thing, we have to be thinking about it. We have to be aware of it.
Exactly. And not let it overwhelm us, but rather have it inspire us to innovate in a way that that solves a problem or creates a solution that is going to be the least negative if you are a true cynic. I'm an optimist. I'd like to think that we could come up with a really super cool way of addressing this. I just think that we have to start thinking on it now. We can't wait.
I think robotic chicken legs on all of our buildings.
The Baba Yaga approach I get a big thumbs up from
me. It's the way to go.
Yeah. And if, you know, I've always enjoyed the swamp. So I think having a swamp house that can move around in the swamp is pretty awesome.
Now I think we're just in a Miyazaki film.
Yeah, probably. That's okay. I'm all right with that. Well, guys, if you have any suggestions for future topics that we can tackle here on Forward Thinking, I recommend you write us and let us know. The email address is fwthinking@howstuffworks.com. Or you can drop us a line on Twitter, Google Plus, or Facebook. At Twitter and Google Plus, we are FW Thinking. You can search the term FW Thinking in Facebook. Our page will pop up. You can leave us a message on that page, and we will read it. We look forward to hearing from you, and we will talk to you again really soon.
For more on this topic and the future of technology, visit forwardthinking.com. Brought to you by Toyota. Let's go places.
If a new house is on your wish list in the next 5 years, grow your savings faster and experience your dreams with an Ohio Homebuyer Plus account from Kemba Financial Credit Union. A savings account specifically designed to save for a new home where you can earn 7% APY, a $500 matching bonus, and a $1,500 mortgage closing cost credit. Learn more at Kemba.org. Offer expires March 31st, 2025. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. NMLS 292230. Equal housing lender. Federally insured by NCUA.
Are you still searching for your perfect place to call home? Well, now is the time to buy at Fisher Homes. If you're looking to move in before the end of 2024, May could be your last opportunity to start building your dream home and close before the year's end. If you're hoping to move in even sooner, Fisher Homes also has homes that are move-in ready and waiting for you, where you can start enjoying the benefits of homeownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with a new home advisor today at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home.
Picasso knows your vacation home is your best home. It's the place that brings family and friends together. It's where you're the best version of yourself. Picasso makes it easy to co-own a luxury vacation home in amazing locations. Listings start at $200,000 for 1/8 ownership. Picasso does all the work for you. Luxury furnishings, maintenance, billing, scheduling, and more. And you can resell on Picasso's marketplace anytime, historically for a 10% gain. Visit Picasso to see thousands of listings. That's PACASO.com.
This is Malcolm Gladwell from Revisionist History. eBay Motors is here for the ride. With some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Brake kits, LED headlights, whatever you need, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
What's up, y'all? Janice Torres here.
And I'm Austin Hankwitz.
We're the hosts of Mind the Business, Small Business Success Stories, a podcast presented by iHeartRadio's Ruby Studios and Intuit QuickBooks. Join us as we speak with small business owners about the tools they use to turn their ideas into success.
From finding that initial spark of entrepreneurship to organizing payments and invoices, we've got you covered. So follow and listen to Mind the Business, Small Business Success Stories on the iHeartRadio app or wherever you get your podcasts.